If you spend any time at all on social media, you know just how important the likes are. Getting likes and positive feedback on your posts is money in the bank. It's a sign of social media success. But does the pursuit of online attention and a growing number of followers cause us to compromise ourselves? Researcher Donna Freitas has found that our engagement with technology has led to what she calls the happiness effect. What this means is that we are very easily driven to appear perfect at any cost, including our ability to be vulnerable, honest, and in community. We're talking to Donna Freitas about her book, The Happiness Effect, and a whole lot more on this episode of Youth Culture Matters.
From the Center for Parent Youth Understanding, this is Youth Culture Matters. If you're a parent, youth worker, educator, counselor, grandparent, or anyone else who cares about kids, we're glad you've joined us for this practical, informative, and hope-filled podcast. This is a place where together we talk and think Christianly about the rapidly changing world of today's children, teens, and young adults.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Youth Culture Matters. And today, I'm Walt Mueller. Well, I'm always Walt Mueller. Every day I'm Walt Mueller, and I'm with Jason Sochnik.
Yeah. You seem unsure of yourself right now,
no,
Jason.
No, no. What? Did you just call me Jason?
I'm just confusing you.
Yeah, that's an insult.
I'm just trying to see if...
Yeah. No, that's the worst thing I've ever been called. Anyway, I'm Walt Mueller here with my good buddy Jason Sochnik, and we are going to have a conversation today about social media with someone who has done some pretty neat research. Donna Freitas has written a book called The Happiness Effect, and we're excited to have her on. And I think, you know, both of us use social media, some more than others. Jason, you're kind of the Instagram king, right? Is that what you're known as out there? Are you on Instagram?
That's not what I'm known as.
Are you on Instagram?
I am on Instagram, yeah. I'm on Instagram. I'm on Facebook, but
Pinterest?
You're
on Pinterest?
No.
You're not on there? Okay.
I'm not. No.
All right.
No, are you?
I'm on Facebook. That's it. And I'm on Facebook, and we do have a CPYU Twitter account here, but I try
to
limit
it. I mean, I really do try. Instagram account now.
Yeah, we do have a CPYU Instagram account. That's Kenton's running that, so I haven't talked to him lately about how much he's been putting up on there, but you're doing social media stuff right now, aren't you, while I'm looking at you, correct?
I'm CPYU Instagramming right now, this podcast.
Okay. We're going to have this great conversation about social media, but before then, I understand there's a quiz or a question Chris and Kenton have.
Yeah, we have a history of social media pop quiz. We'll just 6 short questions. We'll go back and forth between you and Jason.
I'm going to flunk this. I know it already.
They're pretty easy. There's nothing difficult here, but just kind of go back in time to some of the early beginnings of social media. So, Walt, first question for you.
Oh, boy.
What was the name of the first default friend that everyone had on MySpace? When you created a MySpace account, you had one default friend.
Oh, man. I have no idea. You know, I never had a MySpace account, so I can't tell you what that would be. Was it Bob?
It was not Bob.
John?
Jason, do you want to try to
I don't know. I never had a MySpace account.
All right. Kenton, do you know?
I actually never had a MySpace either.
I didn't either, but you. Well, that flunked. We have a guest in the studio.
Right,
do you have a guest?
John Parrott's in here from Mississippi. Do you know what it is?
I have no idea.
Okay, has no idea either.
All right, the answer. I thought these were going to be easy. The answer was
it Iggy Goretzky?
Was Tom?
Tom.
MySpace Tom. He's known as.
Okay.
MySpace Tom.
His photo would show up on everybody's profile. It's sort of a famous photo for people who were on MySpace because it was the first friend. He was one of the co-founders. Tom Anderson was his name. He was one of the co-founders of MySpace.
Mm. Is it CJ Raisin?
Was it CJ Raisin? Was that?
I want a story on where are they now of MySpace Tom. Where are they now, MySpace Tom?
Well, he's not on MySpace.
Maybe
he is by himself.
I did see some articles that would answer that question when I was researching for coming up with this quiz, but I didn't happen to read what he's actually up to now. But
okay, all right.
All right, Jason, we'll start with you. We're going to stick with MySpace. Maybe this one's a little bit easier. What pop star bought a major stake in MySpace back in 2011 in hopes to revamp the declining social site.
I remember this, but wow. I don't remember who it was.
2011. I'm going to guess
paid $35 million. What was your answer?
$35 million.
Yep.
I said Justin Bieber.
Okay, that is incorrect.
Is it someone named Justin?
It is.
Justin Timberlake.
That's correct.
Okay.
We don't have our bell back really? Here today. Otherwise,
no,
I'd be
that's
ringing.
It. Don't. Yeah, where is
it's
the
on
bell?
Top of Lisa's desk.
Don't oh, know. Boy.
All right. Oh,
gotta go okay. get that.
All right, Walt's got one. All right, moving on. Walt, what year?
John's going to get the bell.
What year did Zanga first launch?
Oh, this was in the 1800s, I believe, because that's what I think it was. Zanga. You mean X-Zanga.
Yes.
X-Zanga. Yes. Yeah.
That's right.
You know what? I'm going to venture a guess here based on conversations I had with a daughter who had a Zanga account. Would 2003 be about the right time?
You're close.
Okay.
Jason, you want to try to steal?
Well, I was thinking like 2005.
All right, the answer is actually 1999.
Wow.
Which oh my is actually, goodness.
Actually, so it was the last decade.
Yeah, I actually thought that it was before 99. That would have been my guess, but 1999 is when it first launched.
Okay.
You guys aren't doing wow. so good with this.
No.
All right.
No. Oh, there it is.
Hey,
the bell's in.
We've got our bell. Thank you, John. All right, Jason, back to you. ICQ yeah. was an early instant message client developed in 1996. Where did its name originate from?
You thought these would be easy?
First of all, yeah, do you what? Remember ICQ?
No, I have no idea what ICQ goodness. Is. Man, are you kidding me? These are not easy. Like, Walt, do you know?
ICQ stands for an idiot came up with these questions, I think. Isn't that what that means? Or ICQ? I have no idea. What is ICQ?
Just say it again.
ICQ. I see you.
I seek you.
Oh, I seek you.
That's okay. where they came up with the name.
Right.
ICQ.
Okay.
So if you don't know what ICQ was, it was like yeah. an early version of an instant messenger
so if you,
platform.
Like AOL
If you're
messenger?
Driving down yes. the highway and you see that on a vanity license plate, turn around and go the other way because it's yeah. creepy. That's flat out creepy.
All right. Well, we'll stick with the instant messaging platform.
Oh, great.
AOL,
oh, get this one.
AOL Instant Messenger had a mascot. What was it? What did it look like?
Oh,
it also had a nickname.
You got this.
Oh, wasn't it a little guy kind of running?
Yes. What color was it?
Was it blue and yellow?
It was yellow, yeah.
Yellow,
and
okay.
It looked like a little running man. They called it the AOL running
was
man.
Was he carrying a sign?
No, I don't believe so. There might have been different variations of it, perhaps.
Yeah, this appeared about the time I had to get glasses, so anything that was small on it, I didn't see.
Yes, the yellow AOL running man.
Okay.
All right, I think...
Oh, yeah,
we'll
take
you,
a bill.
We'll give you that.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, Jason, job, last question. We'll wrap this up.
Yeah.
Which means I win, right?
I think
I've
so.
I've already won.
Well, you know what? This one...
No. Don't
listen.
Pull that out. If he gets this one, he gets all the points and he wins. I hate that rule.
This is a two-parter, so we'll say that if he gets both, he can tie.
Oh, tie.
All right.
What other one did he
See,
get right?
Here we go. Change the rules.
He got he stole your pop star, Justin Timberlake.
Oh, that's right. Yeah,
all right.
Okay.
YouTube launched on April 23rd, 2005. What is the title of the first ever uploaded video?
How to use YouTube.
That would be a pretty logical guess, but no, you're incorrect.
Well, I mean, everything's how to use something. So why would you not have a how to use YouTube as your first video?
Was it whatever happened to MySpace Tom?
Yeah, that's a good one. And it was uploaded by one of the co-founders. Anybody?
Was it ICQ?
If you don't remember, it's okay if you
ICQ.
Don't remember the title.
Which
do you know what the video was about?
Which one of the founders uploaded? Was it you or Tube?
His name was, I don't know if I'm pronouncing it correctly, Jawed Karim.
I'm going to just say you probably just totally
probably botched
that name
the name,
on,
yes.
Yeah. You should have held a sign up and let Jason read it, because then it would really be botched.
That's a fun game.
Yeah, yeah.
I am horrible
All
with
right,
names.
I'll give
so
you
sorry.
This. I'll give you the answer. The title of the video is Me at the Zoo. And it was simply the co-founder standing at the zoo taking a video of himself talking about the zoo. So the bonus question, you're still going to lose even if you get this.
Hard to believe he couldn't get that.
Yeah. What animals were featured behind him in the video?
Oh, that's easy. It was a giraffe, and then it was a penguin, and it was a lion.
All in the same cage, right?
Yeah. Well, no, separate. They edited it. It was in the early days of editing. It took them 2 days to put that one video up.
None
of
those
are correct. And it was only
3 minutes long. Well, do you want to take a
It was
a guess?
Some sort of primate.
Incorrect. It was elephants.
Elephants, okay.
Oh, well, you guys failed miserably. Let's move on.
Yeah.
Elephants.
Let's move on from those easy questions.
Okay.
Well, moving on from that elephant, let's talk about the elephant in the room. That is our podcast for today.
Oh, okay. All right.
You like that segue? You like the segue?
I was afraid you were talking about me.
No. 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 It's actually ICQ.
Okay.
But, yeah. What? Hey, so we today have a guest that's going to talk on social media. So I thought this would be a really good time for us to just connect and talk about some of the dynamics of social media when it comes to some of the work that you've done out of Tim Challey's book, The New Story.
And the Next Story. The Next Story.
The Next Story, yeah. Yes. The Next Story. And so I know that some of the stuff that you work on is experience, theory, theology. So maybe real quick, talk about that, Walt, before we dive into this conversation with Donna.
Right. I was thinking about this morning. Tim Challey's wrote a book called The Next Story, and in it he talks about technology, his own experience with technology, and as a follower of Christ, what difference does my faith make in terms of how I use technology? And, you know, here at CPYU, we really believe that the scriptures speak to all of life, and discipleship, following Jesus, is about all of life. And so we need to be about the business of following Jesus onto this digital frontier and being faithful stewards of the good gift of technology, using it in ways that bring honor and glory to God, as opposed to using it in ways that bring honor and glory to the kingdoms of the world, the flesh and the devil. And we need to teach our kids, obviously, to do the same, youth workers and parents. This is something you need to be talking about all the time. So Challey's, he offered a little scheme for me that I think was really helpful. Let me just pass it on very quickly because it relates to what we're going to talk about today. He talks about, as you said, experience, theory, and theology. Most of us, when it comes to technology, we only function at the level of experience. Something new comes out, we say, ooh, I want that. It's fun. It's helpful. I just want to use the thing. And when we do that, we're inviting things into our life that we really haven't been thoughtful about. So he goes to a second level and says we need to consider theory. The good news is that when it comes to technology, there's a lot more theory that's coming out now. So we always refer back to Marshall McLuhan, and when he says, first we shape our tools and then our tools shape us, that's a theory that says basically, you know, our tools are not neutral. They actually have an effect on us. And so theory is something we need to consider. So what are people saying as the research is coming out about how this stuff shapes us or even misshapes us? And that's why I'm excited about having Donna Freitas on with us to talk about this, because she's done some great research on this and is contributing to what's happening in terms of our understanding of that. And lastly, theology. And theology is really about, you know, how do we bring honor and glory to God? So 1 Corinthians 10:31, to do all things, whether we eat or drink or text or Instagram or use Facebook or whatever, you know, with social media, how do we do that to the glory of God? So we want to offer a balanced perspective, and that's what we're going to work to do today, to move beyond just experience, but to hear a little bit from Don about theory, and then youth workers, we need to draw some inferences from that and some practical responses based on theology. So we always want to bring glory to God. That's the ultimate thing for the follower of Jesus Christ. That's what Challey's talks about. It's been very helpful for me.
Oh, that's excellent. Well, I think that sets up our interview today with Donna really well. Well, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to have Donna on with us to talk about her new book, The Happiness Effect.
Thank you.
In an effort to help you help the kids you know and love navigate the difficult landscape of the emerging digital frontier to the glory of God, we've launched a digital kids initiative here at CPYU. Thanks to a generous grant from a company called DAS, you can access our digital kids initiative and a growing number of free resources and downloads by visiting the website at digitalkidsinitiative.com. This is one more way that we're helping you lead your kids to live lives where their faith in God is integrated into the growing amount of time they're spending with social media and technology. Well, welcome back, everybody, to this episode of Youth Culture Matters. Again, I'm Walt Mueller along with Jason Sochnick, and we're pretty excited about the conversation we're going to have today with Donna Freitas. Some of you are familiar with Donna because in years past, maybe you've read some of her books. She's written novels for children and young adults. We know that many youth workers have plugged into a book she wrote in 2008 called Sex and the Soul, Juggling Sexuality, Spirituality, Romance, and Religion on America's College Campuses, and that was published with Oxford University Press. Donna is a researcher. She's a college professor. She's worked alongside Christian Smith, who actually has written a foreword for this book that we're going to talk about today, and the book is called The Happiness Effect, How Social Media is Driving a Generation to Appear Perfect at Any Cost. And that was published just this last February, again, by Oxford University Press. I've read it. It's a great book. Donna, thanks for coming on and joining us on Youth Culture Matters.
Thanks for having me.
Well, this is fascinating to read because a lot of what we talk about here at CPYU with parents and youth workers and others is, you know, the role that social media has played in our lives. And one of the quotes that we often refer to is from Marshall McLuhan, who said that, you know, first we shape our tools and then our tools shape us. And certainly what you've contributed here to this discussion is some great research, conversations with college students that lead to better understanding some of that theory and seeing the reality of just how social media shapes, or some would even say misshapes us. What was it that motivated you to pursue this thread of research, specifically what you did with college students?
Well, before I answer that, just quickly, I want to, it's interesting that you bring up tools or the idea of tools and how, you know, they can shape us, because so many of the students I spoke with talked about how they felt like they were divided between the students who believed that social media is totally upending our world and every way that we are, our sense of selves, our relationships, our perception of the world around us, how we deal with it. And then the students who think everything has always been the same, we just have new tools to express these things. And so I heard some version of one or the other throughout this, the interview process and in the surveys. But I decided to do this research because my research from Sex and the Soul has really hit a nerve on campuses, all kinds of campuses all over the U.S., whether they're religiously affiliated or, you know, public or private secular. And so I regularly spend a lot of time traveling around to different universities and colleges, and I'm often just sitting around talking to college students. And there was just this tipping point where I would always get a question or two from students or people in the audience when I'd be on a visit about social media and its effect on relationships and our sense of sex and faith and how those two things go together or don't. But there was this moment where I was doing a whole bunch of lecture visits, and I was traveling from one college to another, and there was just this tipping point where I felt like every conversation I was having with college students ended up being a conversation about social media. And they had so many questions. They wanted to know what everybody else felt, what their peers felt about this, and if their peers were going to do that with regard to social media, and how is it affecting their relationships. And so it just kept coming up. It came up so much that that I thought, okay, someone has to look into this. Like, they want to know what everybody else is thinking. And then finally, for a while, I started saying, somebody really needs to do a study about this. And then finally, I was on a plane between trips, you know, between lecture visits. And I was like, okay, maybe I'm going to look into this. And I and so that's how I ended up doing this research. So it really grew out of that initial project.
Just talk a little bit about your methodology, what exactly you did to, you know, in preparation to write the book.
Well, so the research, it's so 13 colleges and universities participated, all different kinds of colleges, much like with Sex and the Soul. In some ways, I modeled the process on Sex and the Soul. So I went to Catholic, evangelical, private, secular, and public institutions. I wanted a range of institution types. And I did both in-person on-campus interviews at the 13 schools, and then I also did a survey with additional students who participated in that. And everything was random sampling, so for the interview process. And so basically, I got literally the each university would just give me a list of about 20 to 25 students from their campus. They would just pull them out of, you know, out of their entire roster in some cases, depending on how big the school was or a portion of the roster. And then I would just contact the students and beg them to come talk to me. And so they weren't volunteering. I was sort of, you know, conscripting them. And the reason why that's important is because, you know, you can send out a call for interviews at a campus and you end up with only students who want to talk about the issue, who are really struggling with the issue. And the value of random sampling is that you really do get a random sampling of what people are thinking. You don't get the people who are just dying to talk about social media, or the people who love it, or the people who hate it. You just kind of get everybody, like a smattering of everybody. So, So I traveled around and I did these interviews, and it was very fun and really enlightening.
And you said, in as I was reading the book towards the beginning, you said that it wasn't too far into the research before you figured out that this study was really about happiness, and thus the title of the book, The Happiness Effect. What is that? What is the happiness effect?
Well, I ended up coming up with the title while I was writing the book because, well, when I was doing the interviews, I didn't have to ask about happiness for students to talk about happiness. It came up all over the place in, you know, throughout all kinds of questions I was asking them. And I realized as I, pretty early on, as I was doing the interviews, like, oh, this is like, they want to talk about the relationship between social media and their own happiness. And, but it wasn't just about, it wasn't just about, does social media make me happy or unhappy? It was what they specifically kept talking about was how they were learning in some way, shape, or form that because of social media, the appearance of happiness has become really important. Not actual happiness, but looking happy, like being, you know, like appearing successful online and cultivating an online image that showcases that happiness, like the fact that they feel joy all the time, that their lives are super successful socially and like financially, that they have the right clothes, that they're getting perfect grades and they're pitching perfect games. And so the value they seem to be imbibing from various places and people was that they really had to appear happy online, even if they were miserable in their own life. And so that was the theme that kept coming up again and again. And so when I was working on the book, I the first section of the book was called, I had tentatively titled it, you know, Masters of Happiness, like Mastering Happiness. And so, because that was clearly the task they were given, they had been, you know, they had been sort of told that like the important thing is that you have to appear happy online. And so they were working hard on cultivating that happy appearance. And so then the happiness effect, I was going to call the second section of the book, The Happiness Effect, because I thought, well, okay, well, what is the effect of working so hard to appear happy on all the time when we're not necessarily actually happy in real life? Mm.
You talk about, you mentioned cultivating, you mentioned that word a couple of times, and you talk about the three C's of social media, the notion that one must carefully craft, cultivate, and curate their public profiles at all times. Unpack that a little bit, you know, how that works itself out, you know, with college students. And I, you know, I everything that I'm seeing and reading in this, you know, we're seeing and hearing it with high school students and even at some level, you know, middle school students as well with age compression, this moves down. But talk about crafting, cultivating, and curating among the college students you talk to.
Well, the reason why I have that section about, you know, the three C's is because those words specifically were words that students kept using again and again as we were having our conversations. They would talk, they would actually literally talk about curating their profiles and curating their photos and curating their comments and crafting a post, the crafting a post that, you know, cultivating a particular image. And so this is their language that they use again and again all throughout their thinking and their conversation about social media. And, you know, these were students who use the word audience in the plural. They talked about their audiences. They're aware that there are, they have multiple publics. So like these are the, this is the language that is coming up when students describe why they need to, you know, cultivate a happy, successful appearance and why they have to be careful when they're crafting a post. They are thinking about which different audiences are going to see which different things. And so, and they're actually shaping, you know, how certain audiences see certain posts, but not others. And so, you know, I this is, you know, when I was in graduate school getting my PhD, you know, back when the internet was just a little fledgling thing that we used in, I think, you know, email was like in DOS, you know, it wasn't a real thing. I was taking hermeneutics, you know, which is a place where you talk about like public and audience and the effect of audience and public on how you act and what you say. And you know, that was a graduate school thing for me. And, you know, here we have an entire generation who is being raised, you know, they're growing up knowing, like, very, you know, very explicitly, they're very, very self-aware that they have an audience and they're performing for that audience. Mm.
You know, one of the things I want to ask you about is we do a lot of work with parents, and I have found that exactly what you're talking about here, the whole idea of crafting, cultivating, and curating, is really, I mean, it's not limited to a specific age group. I think moms and dads do this consistently, not only with themselves, but with the way they present their families and their children online. And in fact, moms, young moms, and again, it's everybody, but specifically when we talk to young moms, the number of young moms who want to, you know, present their family in a certain way and then struggle with Facebook depression. You know, the comparison, you know, Teddy Roosevelt said comparison is the thief of joy. So that's what's interesting to me, because you talked about the real me versus the online me. And in trying to always appear happy, we rob ourselves of joy. Differentiate between the real me and the online me.
Well, you know, the real me for the students I interviewed are they're just the people that they are when they're not sitting beside, you know, sitting behind a screen or, you know, on their phones. And, you know, it's how they're really feeling. You know, they may be angry and rage. They may be really happy. They may be sad and depressed. They may be crying. They may feel like they're unattractive. They may feel beautiful. You know, so it's who they really are in their everyday life. You know, imagine, I guess, in some ways, like the person who like rolls out of bed in the morning and, you know, everyone, you know, when we get up in the morning, well, I think most everyone, we shower, we get ready. Like, you know, if, you know, you might put on some lipstick if you're a lady and then we go out, you know, we sort of prepare our lives, you know, ourselves to go out in the world. And I would say that that's a very, very tame version of, you know, the online me and how we're preparing ourselves to preparing our faces or the face we show the public. And so the students I interviewed felt for the most part that the distance between who they really felt they were, who they felt themselves to be, and the them or like the persona they were projecting online was pretty big. And not everybody said that. You could find, you know, a student here or there who would adamantly tell you, like, oh, no, I'm the same online as I am in real life. But for the most part, students were very aware and disturbed or kind of worried about the kind of self they feel they're expected to express online versus the kind of person they really are. And they also had a hard time with the way they were seeing that distance between reality and what's going on online in their friends and in the people they were dating. So they said they felt like they could look at their friends. Like, I would often hear a story like, you know, if you look at her online profiles, you'd think she has the most perfect life, that she's the happiest person you've ever seen, except I know she's really depressed and crying all the time in real life. Yeah. And so the students really felt worried about that distance.
Jason, you have...
Did that distance ever cause them to change how they were posting or to take a break at all while they were on social media to see if they could change some of the distance between those two personalities?
I would say the former of what you said in terms of changing the way you post, that is the least common response. I guess I saw to the worry that the students expressed about this distance between the real me versus the online me. And that is because we've definitely really taught college students of the risks of not being perfect online, not appearing happy, that it may cost you your future job, that you will be judged in ways by people who have power over you that could be really problematic if you want to be successful in life. And so there is this, you know, they really have an acute sense of the costs of not conforming to these expectations they feel, you know, for how they're supposed to post and how they're supposed to appear. But I would say that what I did see all of the time, or that I heard about all of the time, were students who would take breaks. They had all kinds of amazing ways of getting offline, you know, or they had tricks for sort of getting themselves like unaddicted to certain platforms. But they definitely, I guess, took sabbaticals from social media, or sometimes just from one platform. Like, they would decide no more Twitter, and they would, you know, take off their Twitter account, or no Facebook for 6 months. And I did have a few students who would quit social media altogether. I had students who would take sabbaticals like kind of regularly, like, you know, they would do it every, you know, every semester during exams, or every 3 months, you know, they would take 3 months off. And so a lot of them were doing this. And I would say, though, that it was rare to find someone who just quit for good, because students also feel that despite their stresses around social media and all of these things that they don't totally like about it, they feel like the expectation is there that they have a presence, and that is a professional expectation from future employers. And so they're sort of damned if they don't maintain a presence.
That's interesting. That's really interesting. We need to take a break.
Yeah.
But when we come back, I know that we have a number of different questions. I'm actually interested in average age at which they might have first started using their phone, if you found there to be an average age among the many people you interviewed. But I'm also curious if they come right out of the gate wanting to curate this image, because that's what they've been taught. So as soon as they received a phone, that's what they started doing, or it was something that they learned over time. I think that's really interesting, some of the habits and some of the things that you're talking about. But let's take a quick break, and we'll be right back with Donna Freitas here in a moment.
Here at the Center for Parent Youth Understanding, we want to help you stay up to date on today's youth culture. One of the tools we've developed to keep you current is our weekly Youth Culture e-update. Delivered to you by email, our Youth Culture e-update comes to you in a format that allows you to easily scroll through and quickly choose those stories and resources that will be most helpful to you in your particular setting. To sign up for this free resource, go to our website at cpyu.org, scroll down to the bottom of the page, and enter your email address in the tab marked e-update sign up. It's that simple. Well, welcome back again, everyone, to Youth Culture Matters, and we've been having a great conversation with Donna Freitas. Donna is the author of a new book called The Happiness Effect, How Social Media is Driving a Generation to Appear Perfect at Any Cost. As always, you know, we have someone like this on the podcast. We want to recommend to youth workers and parents that you get this book, you read this book. There is so much great information in here. And it's not just information about what's happening. We'll talk a little bit later with Donna as we finish up here about how to begin to tap into social media and how we help kids learn how to manage this in healthy ways. And even for herself, she's got some great advice in there. But before we continue the conversation, Donna, we do this fun little thing. Well, it's usually fun. We hope it'll be fun for you, called Take Five. It's just a way for people who listen to get to know you a little bit. And so Jason has come up with five questions. Do you have five, Jason?
Five questions.
Okay, five questions. Yeah. He's going to fire at you, and just off the top of your head, go and answer them. I take no responsibility for any of the questions that he asks, because we never know what's going to come out of his brain. And he said he's not.
Sometimes I don't even know until
they're
asked.
He's a little under the weather now, and so he says he's not functioning at 100%, which is actually quite scary. So go ahead, Jason.
Okay. Donna, let's start here. What in all of the books that you've done between, Sex and the Soul and now The Happiness Effect, do you have one favorite interview that stood out to you and why?
Well, that's such a hard question. I guess I might cheat and say that there's two. But maybe my most interesting, riveting interview I told in the introduction of The Happiness Effect for this book, and it was the sorority girl that I interviewed. She was just riveting to me. And then I would say that there was another interview for this project too. Sometimes, you know, you interview people and they remind you of people you know. And she was this hilarious woman. She made me laugh constantly, and she looked exactly like my best friend from growing up. I actually named her after my best friend from growing up in the book. I won't say the name, but but she made me laugh really hard. But it's always sort of funny when people you interview remind you of other people, or they remind you of celebrities.
Yeah, that's great. Okay, next question. Mountains or the beach, and why?
Oh, the beach, definitely. I grew up on the beach, and my mom was like, she was a teacher, and pretty much the second she, you know, stopped teaching for the summer, you know, she would take me to the beach from like 7 in the morning, and then my dad, when he got out of work, would drive to this pizza place and pick up pizza, and we'd be there till it got dark. So that was my life in the summer growing up in Rhode Island.
Oh, I was going to ask. My follow-up was West Coast or East Coast?
That's exactly what I was going to ask.
Because I'm an East Coast guy. And man, when you get East Coast New England, it just doesn't get any better. It's awesome.
Yeah, specifically, it's not just East Coast New England.
That's it.
For me.
That's it. Oh, yep.
Wow. Yeah. My picture is always of West Coast, but that's where I've spent most of my life. You two have been on the East Coast all your life.
The sun comes up.
That's where you're wrong.
Yep, the sun comes up for us. The sun goes down for you.
That's not the first time I've been told that. Okay, so you've gotten to go to a lot of different cities with some of your travel. And so I'm just curious, a lot of times when we go to cities, you have to try other food. What's the most interesting food you've ever tried?
I went to this amazing visit. I was in Washington State at Gonzaga.
Hey, that's my home state.
Wait, that's where he is.
That's where I'm at right now.
Yeah, the people at Gonzaga, who were really fabulous,
Spokane,
I really wanted them to win.
That's my hometown.
Well, I really wanted them to win the NCAAs this year. I feel connected to them. I spent like 4 days with them and at the campus, and I loved it. So, but they took me to this really cool restaurant whose name I cannot remember, but it's pretty popular there. Like, it's like a fancy like farm to table restaurant, and they do a special burger every week. And that week it was ostrich. So I had, but I mean, it was like, it was, so I had never had ostrich before, and I got it, And I was a little, I'm sorry, I'm wrong. It was Kangaroo. That's what it was. It was Kangaroo. And I was a little, felt a little bad about myself for eating it, but it was very tasty.
Hmm. See, that, now there's an affinity here. Do you know the name, Jason? Do you know what restaurant this is?
I don't know. I'm trying to think who has a special burger every week, and I don't know that.
It's like a farm-to-table, nose-to-tail kind of restaurant where they make their own sausages.
Nose-to-tail?
It's really excellent. Yeah, you know, if they use the whole animal, they get the whole animal and use the whole animal.
That you know, actually, awesome. That, let me just say something. I'm in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania right now, and I have friends who, this will probably get me in trouble with people, but I have friends who run meat processing plants, and the reality is that they use the whole animal here too. It's not stuff you want to know, but I've seen it happen, and it's quite amazing. Good stewardship, I guess. I don't know.
Oh, man. Well, now I'm going to have to find out where this is at. Okay, but we'll move on. Next question. If you could be any age for a week, what age would that be and why?
Oh, gosh.
I told you it gets weird.
I mean, maybe. Let's see. Maybe like 27, because I feel like that was an age where I was actually like, I got a little bit wiser. You know, you think you're so wise right after you graduate college, but you're not. And I feel like I was still like young enough to go out really late at night, but I was wise enough not to do anything totally stupid anymore. So that was kind of it was a good age, I think.
27, okay. Kenton. All that's right. What you got to wait for. Kent, how old are you, Kenton? 23?
Yeah, I'm 23.
Yeah, you've got 4 years.
I'll look forward to it.
Yeah.
Okay, this is the last one, but this is a favorite that I enjoy asking. We do this in our interview process. So what's one song that you turn to when you just need a pump me up, when you just need to be, you know, full of adrenaline and you just need to get excited for something? What's one song that you'll throw on and be like, ah, oh, this is my go-to get me pumped song?
I'll give you two. They're both recent,
yeah.
And they're totally embarrassing, but I don't care. So one is that Justin Timberlake song about, like, it's like dance. It has dance, 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 and I don't even know the name. Maybe that's the name of it.
Oh yeah,
dance,
Can't Stop
dance,
the
dance.
Feeling.
Yes, that song makes me so happy. And also,
you know, if the second song is from a guy named Justin as well.
Oh, this is it not is. Good.
Oh,
it is.
Man.
It's Justin Bieber.
That's
baby.
What I was afraid of.
I really just can't help tapping my feet to that song. Yeah. And I don't care if the whole world knows it.
Right. Well, that's good.
Wait,
you're brave.
Justin
that
Bieber,
is amazing.
What's my song?
Baby. That's
oh,
what it's
baby.
Called.
Yeah.
It's such a great song. I do have other tastes in music, but I really do enjoy those two songs.
Huh.
Oh my goodness.
Now you're disgusted with me and wish I wasn't on the podcast.
No.
Yeah. You did a great job.
Yeah. Jason
Donna,
Jason
thank
would
you.
Jason's choices would be even worse than that, so oh boy. Hey Jason, follow up those questions you asked before the
yes.
break. I'm really interested in hearing.
Yeah. So well, going back to the question we asked right before we came to the break, it was, what did you find to be the average age at which most of the students you were interviewing received a smartphone? And then the follow-up to that is, did they go right into curating, or was it something that they learned as they had the phone?
Well, I would say that it's more when did they have their first profiles online. For it, you know, the range and ages for when people got smartphones were all over the map. I think there was only a total of, you know, for the students I interviewed, which was, I don't know, like 184 students, it was, I think, about maybe 4 students didn't have a smartphone when I did the interview. So that almost every single person had a smartphone. And some of them had just gotten them before college, so it was the kind of thing that they got before college. A lot of them had them for years already. It often depended on the financial background of the family. And so, or, you know, if they, like, some of the students bought them themselves. And so some of it depended on that. But I would say what was more like most students get their first profiles on Facebook and various, you know, on Instagram at a younger age than they have a smartphone. So that may be changing now, but for the students I interviewed, that was pretty much the case. And I would say that most students got their first accounts somewhere around 12, 13 for a good portion of them. Some of them 14 or 15, pretty much by the time they were 16, everybody had one. And some of the students who were younger when they got them, like at the 12 or 13 age range, it was something that they kept from mom and dad. So like this was something that they hid because mom and dad wouldn't have let them, you know, have it that young. And I would say that what was very clear from the interviews, and I don't know if this will change with time, but there was kind of a grace period, it seemed, where students, you know, they would look back on their first years and their, you know, when they first got a profile, and they would be like, oh my gosh, I can't believe that I acted the way that I did online. And they would sort of laugh about it. And so for like a year or two, they would talk about how silly they were, or how they would put up really dumb pictures and they didn't know any better, or they would be mean to people, or, you know, they couldn't believe all the drama and they would never do that now. Like they all know better. And so there was this sense of like, when you first get on, like if you're in middle school, you can kind of do whatever you want and no one is really gonna care. Like they're not gonna, you know, if a future employer sees the stupid picture you put up, you know, of yourself back when you were 12, they're just going to chuckle and forgive you for it. However, when you're 15 or 16, they're not going to forgive you. And so you better take that picture down. So I would say that there's this grace period where they're allowed to play around and be themselves. And then that goes away pretty much by high school.
Hey, Donna, let me shift gears here. I want to ask you about anxiety, because we continually hear that anxiety is now the number one concern at the healthcare facilities on college campuses, and it doesn't matter what kind of college it is, but much like you conducted your interviews at a wide array of schools, a full spectrum of types of schools, the same thing, anxiety is a problem on campus. They're treating that anxiety, stress, depression. Time magazine back in November ran a cover story on teenagers and anxiety, so it's a huge issue. Did you come away with any sense after your interviews as to how technology and smartphones play into or feed anxiety? Was there any clear connection you saw there as a researcher?
I would say there's two different issues. So one is, you know, smartphones have changed everyone's lives because now we're expected to be on 24/7. And students, regardless of their attitudes towards social media, often felt like they even needed to be available on their smartphone for messages and calls, or, you know, people contacting them in the middle of the night. And so, you know, for some students, sleep was okay. They were allowed to turn off their phone. But for some, they felt like they even had to be available while they were sleeping. And so I think that, you know, if you really sit down and think about that, like, you know, it's essentially we're like the CNN of access at this point. You know, we're expected to be available and on call 24/7, or kind of like we're doctors or, you know, surgeons. So I think that that is part of it, the idea that we must always be available. I would say the other thing is it has to do with, you know, sensitivity and vulnerability. Students, so there were some students, I would say that there's a good portion of the students I interviewed were engaged online, but they were also kind of apathetic about it. You know, they did it, but they didn't really care. Like, you could tell that they were just like, whatever, you know, this is something I'm supposed to do, or this is how we get in touch with people now. And like, they didn't love it, they didn't hate it, but they just kind of had it because it's what people did. And then you see the students who are absorbed by it, whether because they're obsessed because they think they're amazing, like they love like performing, or because it just makes them miserable and desperate and they spend all their time comparing themselves to others. And so I would say that the students who are emotionally you know, engaged in social media are also incredibly made anxious by it. Mm. So there's two different issues, I think, that contribute to stress and anxiety.
Okay, so that leads to questions about relief and how do we function without these phones. In chapter 10 of your book, The Happiness Effect, you title that My Smartphone and Me, A Love-Hate Relationship. You've got a couple of quotes at the beginning of the chapter, one from Jackson, a senior at a public university in the Midwest. He says, as far as my phone, my wallet, my keys, they have to be present. If they're not present, then I'm missing something. That's like me missing my heart or me missing my brain. And then the second quote from Katrina, a senior at a public university in the Northeast. She says, it's a perfect day because I left my smartphone at home and I feel naked right now. I really feel naked. And then you go on in that chapter to talk about this gal, Blair, who dropped her phone in the ocean and just by, I thought that was brilliant, just by out of necessity, she's without it for a week. And what she learns, you know, the reason I'm asking about this is that when we talk to youth workers and we're talking about social media and technology and smartphones, one of the issues they lament is they're walking a balance. It's a balancing act. You know, we're going away for a weekend retreat with our students. Do we let them have their phones? Do we not let them have our phones? And when we talk to youth workers who have taken the phones away or said, hey, no phones this weekend, obviously they get pushback from parents. How am I going to get a hold of my kids? Well, you know, we say, you don't want to get a hold of your kids. Enjoy a weekend. You know, they're fine. If you need to get a hold of them, somebody can make contact. But so they, it's kind of like what Jackson said. Well, both of them, Jackson and Katrina, you know, I feel naked without it or I'm missing something. But then very quickly, something happens. They're disengaged from technology and they're engaged with real flesh and blood people and something happens and you talk, we've seen that, youth workers have seen that, but you talk about that in the book. Talk a little bit about that. What happens when we shut down? Does life get richer?
Well, I would say to any youth workers, parents who are listening to this right now, who feel a bit stressed out about asking their kids or the, you know, the students that they're working with to unplug, like, calm down, like, don't feel bad about it, because even though, you know, they will resist you, even though they might get angry and grumble, you know, even though they may feel twitchy and like almost have withdrawal for a day or two, or depending on how long, you know, you're asking them to unplug, you know, student after student after student that I interviewed, like almost to a person throughout the study, without me even having to ask, brought up a time in their lives where they had gone on, you know, a volunteer trip to India and their phone didn't work, you know, while they were there. And at first they were so upset because they're so used to being connected. But by the second or third day, they were like, this is the best trip ever. Like, I'm able to have conversations I've never had before with people. I'm making friends faster because we can't get on our phones. And they were just amazed by, you know, the liberation, the experience of being liberated from this constant thing they have in their hands, this thing that asks of them, that, you know, that they feel like they have to attend to, that needs them and that they need. And so many students, you know, talked about how their parents like forcibly took their phone away on a vacation and how they hated mom and dad the first 2 days. But then even if they didn't tell mom and dad, they felt secretly grateful mom and dad had done this. And so I had students who told me that the reason why they went to church, you know, once a week was because it was the one place they really just couldn't take out their smartphone and they wanted that hour of peace. And so I would say that, you know, managing the ability to disconnect, to unplug, is something that every single person I spoke to is really struggling with, and they appreciate the help. And so, you know, I feel like we have been too quick to give Wi-Fi access every single place, including our vacation spots and like restaurants. And what I keep seeing are students who you know, they can't really imagine giving up their smartphone altogether, but they don't want to be a slave to it. And they do feel like a slave to it. And they need help unplugging. They need help with like Wi-Fi free spots. And so any way that we can, I would say, empower them to put away their phones, even if it's for an hour or if it's for a couple of days, we are like, they will be grateful. They'll be happy about it.
Huh. I like that's that. Really interesting. Well, as we close out this episode, I would love to just circle around to something you write about in your book, which is your discussion around Aristotle, virtues, and best practices. And I think that these are some of the things that we can leave our youth workers and parents with. And so I would love for you to just to hit upon a few of those aspects that you covered in your book with regards to each of those. And so maybe some of the things that stand out to you even now after having written it.
Well, I guess I'll start with the first one because I think it's one of the most important and we haven't talked about it yet, which is it's called the virtue of vulnerability, honoring our thinner skins. And, you know, one of the things I heard so much about with the students is how I need to have a thicker skin. I need to have a thicker skin. And in order to endure some of the pain they feel when they go on social media, whether it's because they feel left out, whether it's because seeing all the successes of everyone else makes them feel bad about themselves, whether it's because people are being mean to them. You know, there is this sort of command they seem to feel is out there to develop the thick skins so they can endure this pain, you know, better, and meanness and the cruelty of the online world. And it made me think a lot about vulnerability. You know, where is vulnerability in this picture here? You know, essentially students are learning, you know, the young people in our lives are learning that to be vulnerable is a problem online. It will only, you know, leave you open to being very, very hurt. And so we've got to steel ourselves. We've got to make ourselves invulnerable. And so I started thinking, you know, they talk so much about developing a thick skin. And I started thinking about how, well, we don't want our skin to get too thick because then we won't feel anything at all. And so that was one of the things, I guess, how can we teach this generation, teach ourselves, you know, who, you know, whether regardless of any age, you know, I know a lot of my friends are struggling with this issue, you know, online and on their profiles. But I think we need to really take a look at vulnerability and how social media is affecting our ability to be vulnerable and to value vulnerability. So the other one I want to bring up is playfulness. And just goofing off. That was one of I think it's number five, maybe. No, it's number six.
Number six.
The virtue of play, why goofing off is important. And, you know, that may sound weird or off as a virtue, except I can't tell you, you know, if you think about the title of my book, The Happiness Effect, and how that is really, the title is all about or came from the fact that students, you know, the young people that I spoke with are learning that to appear happy online is everything. To curate a perfect successful image is their job. Like it's how they're going to make a future for themselves and a successful professional future. And they're learning that the appearance of happiness is more important than their actual happiness. And so they are curating. And, you know, one of the things that came up in the study so much was how much they love Snapchat. And it's because their posts disappear, snaps disappear, because those, even though everybody knows that people can take a screenshot, what they really wanted was just a place where they could take goofy pictures of themselves and send them to their friends. They wanted to say silly things. They wanted to play around. And they feel like because of the expectations around image that we have out there for young people now on how they're supposed to behave online, they're not even allowed to put a goofy photo up because that may cost them their professional future. Like this is sort of, these are the stakes they've been given. And so I think we need to take a step back and think about, you know, what is this costing the children in our lives and the young adults in our lives? Because playing around and having fun, I think, is really important. Mm. I would say just the last one, which we've already touched on a little bit, is just so many students, when I ask them at the end of the interviews, you know, is there anything else we haven't talked about that you want to bring up, you know, in the interview? So many of the students had said, something like, I'm worried because I don't feel like we know how to be alone anymore. I don't feel like we know how to sit still. And, you know, for anyone who's, you know, working with youth and or who's doing retreats, you know, with youth, you know, that is part of what we try to do, I think. We try to give, you know, the young people in our lives a space to step away from all the chaos and the noise and listen to themselves, like try to, you know, dive within a little bit and see what's there without all these devices that distract us, and to see what they hear, you know, inside themselves. And, you know, I think they need to unplug to do that. Like, we don't know how to do that anymore. It's really hard for us to sit still and to be in that kind of quiet. Students even talked about how they fear it. They fear time alone without that phone they can reach for because they're afraid of what they're going to hear inside themselves. And so I would say really thinking about that with the young people that you work with or the children, you know, that are yours, how can I teach my child or the student that I'm working with how to be at peace with sitting still, even if it's a little bit hard.
Mm. I like how you say that. And earlier when we were talking to you, you mentioned the word, you know, Sabbath, and, you know, taking a social media Sabbath, which is so important. You know, we've been created for a rhythm of work and rest, and we really need to get in step with that. I mean, it's liberating in so many ways. So I love that. You actually titled that The Virtue of Unplugging, The Capacity to Sit, Think, and Be Alone. Well, we've been talking to Donna Freitas. This has been a great conversation, Donna. Thank you so much for coming on and chatting with us. And we're going to recommend that people read The Happiness Effect. It's a great book for youth workers and parents to just get a sense of what's happening. You know, there's good, and there are things in here to be concerned about as well. So thanks for blazing this trail for us. By the way, where are you right now? You're overseas, right?
I'm in Barcelona.
Oh, okay, Barcelona. It sounded there for a minute like the police were coming to get you, but I'm glad you've stayed on. So no, that's fine. We love it. We recorded an entire podcast with a guy who had two large, I think, John Deere riding mowers outside of his window cutting his grass, and it was just funny. So yeah, it's all part of podcasting.
There's a terrace, so so there's a, you know, you can hear, I guess, the sounds of the city a little bit.
Okay. All right. Okay. Great. Well, thank you for coming on, and I hope that we get a chance to talk to you again. This has been so helpful. Jason, anything you want to say as we close out?
No, this has been great. Donna, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it.
Oh, right. I've enjoyed the conversation. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. And as always, folks, we're going to put links up to everything that is mentioned here, including Donna's site. What's the URL for your site, Donna, your website?
It's just DonnaFreitas.com, so okay. myname.com.
That's easy enough, and we'll include a link to that, links to all the books, anything else we've mentioned here. And I think as well we're going to link to some of the YouTube videos that are out there. Donna's done some great presentations at colleges, universities, and elsewhere, and so we want to give you a little more of a taste of what she's thinking about some of the wisdom. So thanks so much. Well, everybody, thanks for joining us, and we look forward to chatting with you again in the future on another episode of Youth Culture Matters.
Thanks for joining us for Youth Culture Matters, a podcast from the Center for Parent Youth Understanding. If you'd like to learn more about today's youth culture, visit our website at cpyu.org. And if you have any questions, comments, or feedback, email us at podcast@cpyu.org.